You're listening to a podcast from York City Church. If you like what you hear and you would like to find out more, please visit our website at www.yorkcitychurch.org.uk.
Well, good morning, everyone. Are you sitting comfortably? I'm glad you recognise that. Well, then I will begin. Yeah, I was going to. Yeah. So, if you don't know who I am, I've actually been here the last couple of weeks. So, this is my third and final Sunday with you, wonderful people. My name is Ian Galloway. I'm from Newcastle. For 33 and a third years, I did Alan's job in City Church in Newcastle, and I've recently stopped doing that in order to sort of step into what God is calling me to do. And I've done this 20-year kind of slightly obsessed study in the Gospel of John. I was asked to teach it at quite a senior level, and it sort of moderately scared me, so I began to kind of study it. Thought, gosh, I better find out what this is all about. And it totally captivated my attention. I've been studying it in depth ever since, mostly on my holiday, because that's the only spare time I actually have to do sort of a consistent piece of work. And my poor wife, Heather, has sort of got used to that. And I've stopped being the lead pastor at City Church in order to kind of be launched into the next phase of all of that and take it to another level. Because what I can see God wants me to do is to design and produce some immersive experiences in the gospel. Imagine that. So I'm talking to a virtual reality company, I'm talking to an augmented reality company. Now, a few months ago, I didn't even know there was augmented reality. I've got a sense of how to get you inside the gospel, because what I'm convinced of is that the gospel was written so that you can meet with Jesus. You know, it's one thing, isn't it, to write a book and to say, look, just read my book. And books was, you know, writing was the technology of the day. You know, here's my book, read that, and it'll tell you what happened to my friend Jesus. That's one way of writing, and it's the way most people write. It's quite another thing to say, look, I've written this book. I want you to read it. I want you to kind of get your head inside it. And when you do that, when you read my book, you'll meet someone. You'll meet my friend Jesus, and he'll form a friendship, and then he'll take it from there. That's quite another way to write. And that's what I think is going on. And so I want to design these immersive experiences to get people inside the gospel. You know, I was scuba diving in the Maldives, and I met this... When you scuba dive, you meet really nice people and get to know them. And I met this German guy called Jorge, and one lunchtime he came to me in the restaurant, and he says, "I want to know about your church." And he had no church background, he had no Christian background. In fact, he'd rejected the whole thing. He thought the corruption in the church was proof that it was wrong. And he said, "I want to know about your church." He said, and so we talked the whole afternoon. It was a bit cloudy, we didn't go diving, we just talked in the bar about church, about Jesus, about faith, about all that kind of stuff, about the Bible. And at the end of it, he said, "Look, I want to go on a spiritual journey. Have you got a spiritual journey for me to go on?" And I thought, do you know what? I haven't. I actually haven't. And I need to have one. And this is part of what I want to do, these immersive experiences, is for people like Jorge who are interested and know there's something, and maybe have met you and realized, well, maybe there is something in this faith thing. But they don't know what to do next, and neither do you. And this is a way of getting them inside the Word of God. So Basically, I'm starting by writing a book, and this is where I need your help, okay? People have, over the last couple of weeks, asked me, when's your book going to come out? And the true answer is I haven't actually started writing it yet. But I'm hoping, you know, like by the summer or by the autumn, it will be ready. And people have asked me that and said, well, we'd like to know. So I've got a sign-up sheet. So if you would like to know, you know, please don't feel like pressurized by this at all. But if you would like to know, when's the book out in? And I'll send you a text or send you an email and you can buy it. That'd be great, wouldn't it? So sign up and pass that round, and that will help me as we go along. So last week we were looking at get going. Flipping it. We're doing it now, okay? It's a kind of diversionary activity in case the preaching is a bit too boring. Pass it round, okay? Make sure you get all the way around. Last week we were looking at these two stories side by side, okay? We were looking at the wedding at Cana, which is in chapter 2, and we were looking at the healing of the royal official's son, which is chapter 4, and we were looking at those stories side by side, and we saw that they've actually both got the same storyboard. A significant person, mum in the wedding, dad in the healing of the royal official's son, a significant person comes to Jesus to ask Jesus to help another person. They have no more wine, says his mum. My son is sick, says his dad. Jesus appears very reluctant. There's a massive kind of pushback on this request in a way that perhaps none of us have ever done and probably never will do. You know, woman, he says to his mum, which is an interesting way to start a conversation with your mum. This has nothing to do with me, is basically what he says. And he tells the guy off, who's come to ask him, desperate for prayer for a sick son. He tells him off. Unless you people see signs and wonders, you just haven't got any faith. What's the matter with you? And it's like, whoa, what's going on here? But actually, that pushback is an opportunity for someone to step forward in faith. The person doesn't go away sulky. They step forward further, closer, nearer to Jesus. And then Jesus totally changes direction and he gives instructions as to what to do. And actually, he invites everyone else to step into the miracle and to be part of the miracle. And people participate in the miracle. And then a small group of people who really know the whole story and see it, they come to faith in Christ. We saw that last week, and it was, you know, moderately interesting. And I set you some homework. And that was to find some more like this. In the Gospel of John, note, I don't want Mark or Luke. Okay, I want John. Are there any other stories like this? Because, you know, when you want to get to know someone, okay, you hear their story, don't you? Coffees, beers, meals, walks, they're all means for something, you know, much greater, something much more significant, which is getting to know somebody. That's why we do these things, maybe even finding love. You know, and relationship, and particularly deep relationship, is what we all crave, and indeed what we all need. A socially isolated person is actually an ill person. And talking with friends is much more about hearing about their past, or if you know the right kind of people, hearing some hilarious stories. If you are actively engaged and listening to their story, if that's what you're doing, you don't just hear about what happened to them, you see the person in the story. That's what goes on. I'm in here somewhere. You've been getting to know me a little, just in me being here. You've heard a little of my story. You're seeing the me that is in the story. That's how relationships grow. And as your friendship develops and the stories become more and more vulnerable, the person who is present in the story comes more and more into view, and you feel more and more connected to them. That's how it works. And you know, it's always two-way in a friendship. As you get to know me, okay, and I then get to know you. One doesn't happen without the other. And as I get to see you As I hear your story and I get to see you in the middle of that, I become like a mirror to you as well. I help you see yourself because I see you. So you see me seeing you. And that is very, very profound. That's how we all help one another discover who we actually are. We become like a mirror to one another. And obviously, you know, the whole problem with the labels thing is it's a very distorting mirror. It doesn't tell you the truth. But if you've got a relationship of love and of trust, and you're a good listener, you become a good mirror to the other person. You show them who they really are. And that's the beauty and the joy of deep friendship. And why am I saying all this? Because the Gospel of John has been written so that you can develop a deep friendship with Jesus. That's why it's been written. So that you can know him. And in the knowing of him, you can know yourself as he sees you. John has created this space in the gospel where you don't just hear what happened to Jesus, although that is important. Like, my story is important. My scuba diving in the Maldives is important to the understanding of me. You don't just hear the story of Jesus in the gospel. You see the person of Jesus in the gospel, and you become face to face, heart to heart with a living Jesus. Not here in the flesh, but very here in the spirit. And the Gospel of John takes the reader on this amazing journey to get to know Jesus. So I set you this homework. It wasn't just Bible study, it was relationship study. Are there any more stories with that storyboard in the Gospel of John? Who found some? Who found the two other stories? Wave at me, don't be shy. Oh, there's a little hand there. Did anybody actually do this? There's a hand there? A hand there. Okay, well, woman at the well. Who starts that story? Jesus, yes. He's expressing his need, not the other way around. So we'll do. There's a good option, but it's not the right one. Okay. Any other suggestions? Any other suggestions?
The ones I looked at didn't quite exactly fit, but then there's the story of Mary and Martha sending someone on behalf.
Okay, brilliant answer, and we'll come back to that one. The raising of Lazarus fits this storyboard absolutely perfectly. What's the other one? Feeding of the 5,000. Give that man a clap. Feeding of the 5,000. Woo! Okay, let's read this with me. I think that's what we're going to do next. Yes. Brilliant. Right, read this out loud with me. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing those who were ill. Then Jesus went up a mountainside, sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover festival was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming towards him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he had already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "It would take more than half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and they sat down. About 5,000 men were there. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces, the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. And after the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who was to come into the world." Jesus, knowing they had intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Okay, let's look at this story. Let's ask the same questions as this story as we asked of the other two stories. Number one, where does the story happen? Galilee. Galilee again. Same as the wedding at Cana, same as the official son being healed. Second question, who is there? Jesus and the disciples. Same people are there as at the wedding at Cana and the healing of the royal official's son. Next question, how does the story start? And this is really interesting because it's a bit of a change. It's a bit of a different kind of start to this. Who actually starts this story? It's Jesus who is starting this story. So log that. Who started the story of the wedding at Cana? Mum. Who started the royal official's story? The father. Who starts this story? It's the son who starts this story. We just need to note that because that's a bit of a change. What does he say? The next question. What does he say? What's the need he's looking at? He wants to feed people. So the problem at the wedding is they've run out of wine, or about to run out of wine. The problem at the royal official's son is he's very, very sick. The need here is these other people. So it is another person's need. These other people have gone without food because they're so keen on the teaching. Imagine that. Imagine that being the problem at York City Church. Everyone's starving to death because they're so keen on the teaching. And next question. Somebody else responds to that. Because Jesus has started this story, somebody else has to respond. Who responds? Philip, what does he say? Put this into Middle Eastern language. Take more than half a year's wages to give everyone just a little bite. It's like, man, these people they're excitable and emotional. And he gets really, really, like, this can't be done. This just can't be done. So the reluctance is in the story, isn't it? The need is in the story, same at the wedding at Cana. The reluctance is in the story. But because Jesus started the story, the reluctance is actually in somebody else now. The reluctance is in Philip. But this reluctance creates an opportunity for someone to step forward in faith. So how does, next question, how does Andrew respond to Philip's reluctance? What does he actually do?
He says, "Here's some bread."
Here's some bread, yes. Now, there's not much faith going on here, is he? He says, look, we've got these five loaves. We've got something, you know. Well, it's all these people, but, you know, never mind, there's something. So he's. This is real classic faith, isn't it? You would understand this. You've got some kind of confidence that Jesus might be able to do something, but you've got lots of questions as well. And that's how faith operates. So there's need, then there's reluctance, and then there's the response of faith. So next question, what happens next? What happens next? I'm sorry for making you work on your Sunday morning. It's terrible, isn't it? Get rid of this preacher. He should be telling us everything. What happens next?
They tell him to sit down.
Yeah, Jesus gives instructions. Get this place organized, okay? There's lots of chaos going on. Get it all organized. And we get a lovely little eyewitness detail here, okay? There was plenty of grass in that place. Because John knows that some of his readers will be thinking, well, you're not going to get 5,000 men sitting down in the dust of the desert, are you, on the beach? He says, oh, there was lots of grass in that place. And it's just a lovely, lovely sort of unconscious detail. John wants the doubtful reader to know that the crowd did do what Jesus asked them to do. They did all sit down. They did get it organized. It was all fine. There was plenty of grass. And probably without meaning to do this, John has given us yet another neat detail that communicates to us this is not a made-up story. Someone was there. This is eyewitness narrative. Somebody was there, remembering who said what, counting the loaves, counting the men, and looking at the grass. So, next question, how does the miracle happen? How does it happen? Does like McDonald's turn up with lots and lots of lunches? How does it happen? Who does it? Yeah, it happens in the hands of the people there. Jesus takes the bread, he gives thanks to God, and he breaks it. Now you imagine, like, here's your bread, and there's your 1,000 people. You know, like, you imagine what would you do? Like, okay, I'm giving you your lunch. Here's your lunch. And then, oh, okay, well, look, this is your lunch there. And just imagine. And then you're looking at the bread, and you suddenly realize what's going on. There's no less bread. What would you do then? Think, right, whoa. Now, it's not happening for me here, but... but I am not the Messiah of Israel. Imagine being part of that miracle in your hands, witnessing the feeding of thousands of people from 5 barley loaves. And what's the outcome? What's the outcome of the story? What happens by the end of it?
Everyone gets fed.
Everyone gets fed and tomorrow as well. A number of people have a free lunch tomorrow. What happens at the end is an abundance again. A shortage is turned into a massive surplus. Now, who knows what happened? Who knows how this happened? Who knows what's just happened? Who saw it? The disciples see it because it's happening in their hands, but who else sees it? Everybody sees this one. This is not like the wedding at Cana. It's a development. It's a moving forwards. Everybody sees this actually happen in front of their eyes. What's their response? How do they respond? Not well. They do not respond well, which may partly explain why Jesus did the other two signs in a kind of quite surreptitious manner. Because when everybody sees this one, what do they want to do? They want to make him king by force. Because if you can get bread in people's hands and multiply it by breaking it, what can you do with Romans? What can you do with a couple of Romans in your hands? And they want to make him king by force. Now, Jesus is going to become king, but not by force, by the laying down of life, by the giving up of his life. Jesus will become king. So that's why he withdraws. He can't live with this agenda. They have seen what happened, but they haven't understood what happened. They've seen the sign, but they haven't understood the sign. Welcome back.
Hi.
It's good to see you. Now, can you see it? Can you see it? Can you see the storyboard here? And more to the point, can you see the person behind the story? The significant person starts the story. This time it's Jesus. Bear that in mind. He asks Philip to help someone else. These people need to eat. Philip is reluctant. It would take 6 months' wages and they'd only have a little bite. Andrew steps forward in faith. Well, we've got something here. Here's something. Jesus gives instructions. Get everybody sat down. There's plenty of grass. We can get everyone sat down. It'll all be fine. Let's not do this in a kind of chaotic, rioting sort of manner. Let's do it in a sort of seated, digesting sort of a manner. And the miracle occurs in the hands of Jesus and the disciples after giving thanks and distributing it. And everybody sees it and don't give a very good response. A story follows exactly the same pattern as the other two. Now, fourth story. Fourth story, Rachel, was?
Lazarus.
Brilliant. Give Rachel a clap. Woo! We're not going to read it because we've got too long, but we will interrogate the story. Where does the story happen? Bethany. A short walk from Jerusalem. So we've gone Galilee, 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 Bethany. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. You see, for a man, for the authorities, a man doing signs in Galilee is annoying and has to be investigated. But a man doing signs in Bethany is dangerous and has to be dealt with. And actually, in the Gospel of John, it's the raising of Lazarus that triggers the arrest of Jesus. They can't take it anymore. Fine if you're, you know, out in Galilee, but you're doing it at our front door. This can't go on. Who is there? Well, interesting development to this story. Jesus is actually having time out with his disciples up north. Here's John 10:40. Jesus went back across the Jordan to the place where John had been baptizing in the early days. There he stayed and many people came to him. Jesus has gone to his roots. He's taken the disciples back to where it all began. John baptizing in the Jordan. He's 2 days' walk away from Bethany. Who starts the story? Who starts the raising of Lazarus story? Mary and Martha, two sisters. So we've had mum, dad, son, now two sisters. What do they ask? What do they ask Jesus? What do they say? Lord, they say, the one you love is ill. Now, this is classic Middle Eastern, isn't it? A lot of emotional content here. The one you love, the one, this is an important person, the one you love is ill. No direct request. This is, we're back to the same territory as the wedding at Cana. They have no more wine. This is Middle Eastern women talking to Middle Eastern men. No direct question. Go and get this sorted out, mate. But that is actually what they mean. They're just culturally not allowed to say it. So they say this, well, the one you love is ill. Okay. What they really mean is, come and help us! That's what they mean. Urgent, urgent request, if you want to translate that into English. How does Jesus respond? Well, when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed where he was 2 more days. I mean, is that what you do when you get an urgent request from somebody you love? Well, maybe that's interesting. We'll deal with that in a minute. Urgent request from someone you love. You think, that'll wait till the weekend. I'll wait till next week. Oh, golly. Reluctance. And for those of you who are good at maths, you can actually work out when Lazarus died. Jesus is 2 days' walk away from Bethany, but stays 2 days where he is before he sets off, then walks for 2 days. And when he gets there, Lazarus has been dead how long? 4 days. You guys need to read the Bible a lot more. He's been dead 4 days. So when did Lazarus actually die? What point in the story? When the messenger reached Jesus. So actually, it wouldn't have made any difference. He was already dead when the messenger reaches Jesus. But what's the significance of the 4 days of death? Well, in the Jewish mind, in the Jewish sort of theology, When you died, your soul remained for 3 days. You were still kind of lurking. But 4 days, you were like not just dead, you were dead. You were gone, okay. 3 days, you were still hanging about. 4th day, gone. So Jesus actually makes sure that Lazarus is completely dead. How do the sisters respond when he arrives? Well, when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him. Mary stayed at home, and Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. That's faith, isn't it? We get more of the conversation in John 11. The faith is not unqualified. There are questions in their minds, and there are difficulties that they're facing. But this is faith stepping forwards. Even the reluctance of Jesus has not quenched their faith in him. They step forward towards him. What happens next? What happens next in this story? Well, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. Jesus wept. Jesus is deeply moved. And he weeps. What does that tell us? Well, that tells us some very, very important stuff. Number one, it tells us that Jesus is not a magician. He's not a magician. This is not a resurrection show. This is not Jesus saying, oh, I've got this all sorted. So fine. Stop the crying. Play the drums. Play the trumpets. No. This is where Jesus lives. He can't do anything independently of God. He doesn't have it in himself, separate from God. John 5 tells us, Jesus says this, very truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. Number one, Jesus is not a magician. Number two, Jesus doesn't know the end of the story. You know, when you and I pray for the sick and the dying, we don't know the end of the story, do we? Because we're in the story. We are the story happening. We don't know the end of the story until we get to the end. It's exactly the same for Jesus. I have this prayer ministry to the dying. Monday is my day off. And often it's like on a Monday, people are like, I'm told they're really close to death in the church. So I go in to pray with them. And I normally pray, Lord, hasten it, you know. Get them into the heavenly dwellings in a really good fashion. It's that kind of prayer. You know, a bit more words than that, but, you know, a bit more love. Do you know, nearly all those people recover and come home again. I think, God, what's going on? I think me turning up on a Monday, everyone thinks, it's Ian's day off. It scares the hell out of them. I must be dying. There's no other reason he's going to be here. So that they get better. But I don't know the end of the story when I'm actually there, because I'm in the story. Jesus is the same. He's feeling his way in this story. He doesn't have our perspective of it having all been done. He's taking his time on what might happen next. John 5 says this, Jesus gave them this answer. You know, he, meaning himself, he can do only what he sees his Father doing. Whatever the Father does, the Son does. And Jesus is feeling his way in what's going to happen next. And the third thing just to note is this, God working doesn't take away the sorrow. God working doesn't take away the sorrow and the pain and the loss. Being God doesn't mean that Jesus escapes from sorrow. And we already know this because Isaiah tells us he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, acquainted with suffering. So, that's what happens next. What happens next? Next. And this story's got lots more depth and lots more interest. But what then happens? After the sorrow, what then happens? Well, same thing as all the other stories, Jesus gives instructions. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he says. So how did the miracle happen? How does it actually happen? Well, it's the same combination as the other three stories. People doing what Jesus told them to do. People participate in the miracle. Jesus does it, and it's even more obvious in this case because Jesus speaks out loud in public. But Jesus is also working through the obedience of the others. He says, right, come on, shoulder to the stone, mate. Come on, get on with it. Get on with it. You come, look, we need us. Look, we need you as well. You're a good stone mover.
I'm not moving any stones.
This is excellent. Thank you. Come on, push the stone, guys. Come on, come on. Oi, come on. I know there's no stone. We're just acting. Right, you can sit down and Gav, have a little clap. The obedience is the way that Jesus worked. And actually what's being modeled there is the way that Jesus works with the Father. It's through the obedience of Jesus that the Father works. The same dynamic is now in play in our relationship to Jesus. The way Jesus relates to the Father is the way we now relate to Jesus. And what's the outcome? Well, it's an abundance. Lazarus is called out of death and comes back to life. So four stories that belong together. And as we look through the window of each story, as we look through the window of the wedding at Cana, we see the person of Jesus through the story. As we come around here and we look through the window of the healing of the royal official's son, we see the story of it happening. We also see the person of Jesus that's sitting behind the story and in the story. As we come around and see the feeding of the 5,000, we see the person of Jesus through the story. As we come around again and we see the raising of Lazarus, we see the same Jesus there. Now, he's not a machine. There's complexity, there's depth, there's change. But John's gospel is this holy place. It's a sacred space where the Word of God and the Spirit of God are working together to make God known to you. And not God known just in an informational sense where you can give a description, but to make God known in a relational sense where you can say, I know the man behind the story. Oh, I have found a friend. A most unusual friend, it has to be said, but I have found a friend. And what a strange collection of stories these are. They clearly belong together, but they do look pretty random. Reality is changed by pouring in and out of jars. Healing happens by just walking away. Bread is multiplied and people are fed. And the dead son of a much-loved family is called back to life. They all clearly belong together, but they look pretty random. And this is where I ask you another question. And God, in my little journey in the Gospel of John, asked me this question, and I sat and thought about it for months. And the question is this: where have you seen these stories before, Ian? And I asked you the same question. And did anybody come up with an answer? Paul. Oh, I want to kiss. That's biblical. Greet one another with a holy kiss. And Elisha. Did anybody else go there? Rachel, yeah, well, give these people a clap. This is fantastic. These are the stories of Elisha. They are all in 2 Kings 4 and 5, one after the other. It's not wine, it's oil, but it is the pouring in and the drawing out that does it, and a family in need are saved. 2 Kings 4, 1 to 7. It's not a royal official's son who is healed by walking away. It's a royal official himself who gets healed. He's called Naaman. He comes to Elisha. He gets angry because Elisha won't come out and do the magic. Elisha actually stays indoors and tells him what to do from indoors. He won't even go outside and tell him. He says, just walk away from me. Do what I tell you to do. And Naaman won't do it to start with. He has to be persuaded. But he does it and he is healed. He participates in his own miracle. 2 Kings 5, 1 to 19. Barley bread is brought to Elisha, and he says, set that before 100 men, and that will feed them. And the disciples say, that's ridiculous, it will never work. You see, the request and the reluctance are the other way round in this story, the same as they are in the Jesus story. Exactly the same way round in the Elisha story is the Jesus story. And he says, set that before them, they will all eat and have enough, and there'll be some left over according to the word of the Lord. 2 Kings 4, 42 to 44. And then there's a son in a family that love Elisha and have a little guest room for him in their house, and that son dies, and Elisha is up country and has to be sent for, and when he comes back and is in the home again, the son is raised to life. And something I want you to see is the phenomenal level of correspondence between the 2 Kings 4 stories and the John's Gospel stories. And to do that, we'll just take one, the multiplying of bread, because it's only 2 verses. Well, actually, it's 3. Read this with me. A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God 20 loaves of barley bread baked from the first ripe corn, along with some ears of new corn. Give it to the people to eat, Elisha said. How can I set this before 100 men? His servant asked. But Elisha said, give it to the people to eat, for this is what the Lord says, they will eat and have some left over. Then he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over, according to the word of the Lord. How many points of correspondence can you see? Did you count them as you went through? Well, let's see. Here's the first one. A prophet suggests, give it to the people to eat, Elisha said. Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat? Says Jesus. It's the prophet who starts the story. A prophet suggests, number one. Number two, that everyone can be fed. 100 men in Elisha's story, 5,000 men and women and children in the Jesus story. A prophet suggests that everyone can be fed. Point three, from not very much. 20 loaves of barley bread in the Elisha story, 5 small barley loaves in the Jesus story. A prophet suggests that people can be fed from not very much. Next point of correspondence, the disciples are skeptical and reluctant. How can I set this before 100 men? How can I do that? This is ridiculous. And how far, says Andrew, will this go amongst so many? The disciples just don't believe it's possible. Next point of correspondence, barley bread in both cases, 20 loaves of barley bread. Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves. Another nice little eyewitness detail. This is not wheat or, you know, whatever, corn, barley loaves. Barley bread, next point, is brought to the prophet, a man from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God 20 barley loaves. Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish. The bread is brought to the prophet. Next point of correspondence. He gives instructions. Give it to the people. Make everybody sit down. Next point of correspondence. Everybody eats. Next point of correspondence. And there's some left over. These are the same story. Do you get it? Can you see it? 9 points of correspondence in the same story. You know, we haven't got time this morning to look at the detail, but in the water into wine story, there are 14 points of correspondence with the Elisha story. In the healing of the fish of son, there are 11. In the raising of Lazarus, there are 15. And this is how John has written his gospel. He's written the story of Jesus inside the story of Elisha in these four events. And the best way I can describe that is this picture here. This picture here, there it is. It's a story within a story. It's four stories. Whoa, 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 whoa. Four stories inside four stories. And a nice little audio track as well, because I nicked that off YouTube. Now, those of you who do maths will know what that is. Anybody know what that is? Can we see that again? What is that? That is called a tesseract. That is a four-dimensional cube. You know, when you look at a three-dimensional cube on a piece of paper, you look at it because you represent the sides of the cube with shapes. Now, you know that they're square, but when you look at them on the paper, they're not square. They've been distorted, so you can see it's a three-dimensional piece. That is a four-dimensional cube, and it looks like a cube within a cube. That is what John has done. He's put the story of Jesus inside the story of Elisha. And of course, this raises a very interesting question, which is this. Why? Why? Why do that? Why is it important to us to know that Jesus is an Elisha figure? Well, that's the question I was asked by God. Why is Jesus being Elisha? And to understand that my new friend Jesus is Elisha, I have to read the whole story of Elisha. And to understand the whole story of Elisha, I then have to read the whole story of Elijah. And to understand the whole story of Elijah, I then have to read the whole story of the downfall of the monarchy, which is what I did. But, you know, you haven't got time for that this morning. And so the answer, bring it down to its absolute essence, why is Jesus being Elisha? Well, what was Elisha sent to accomplish? What was Elisha's mission? And the answer is this. It's the mission he received from Elijah. Let's go on to the next slide. This is what Elisha was sent to do: destroy Ahab and Jezebel. Behold, I'll utterly sweep you away, Ahab and Jezebel. I'll utterly sweep you away. I'll cut off from Ahab every male, both bond and free. No descendants of Ahab in Israel. Of Jezebel, the Lord has spoken, saying, the dogs will eat Jezebel in this district of Jezreel. Pretty graphic stuff, isn't it? But the mission of Elijah, passed to Elisha, was the complete destruction of Ahab and Jezebel. You see, what Ahab and Jezebel had done to God's people was so corrupt, it had to be eradicated with nothing left behind. There was no room for compromise or peaceful coexistence. What they had done to God's people had to be completely stopped. And that's what Elijah and Elisha were sent to do. You think, well, why is that? What had they done that had to be completely stopped? And there's a whole group of things they did, but at its heart, it was just one thing, which is this. What they did was control people to get what they wanted. That is what Ahab and Jezebel did. Control people to get what they wanted. Some of that control was aggressive and bullying. Some of that control was deceptive and manipulative. Some of that control was flattery and feeding people. So they became a group. They gathered a group around them that they flattered and fed, and they became a power base, a bigger power base. But the point of having the power base was to do what Ahab and Jezebel wanted. They had an uncontrolling abuse of their leadership role. They had a position of leadership. They were the royal couple, the senior leaders. They did not use their leadership role to serve the nation and bless God's people and do them good. They used their leadership role to get what they wanted. They did not use their leadership to protect people and care for them. They did not use their leadership to create an environment where other people could flourish and thrive. They used their leadership to get what they wanted. And if you cooperated, you were fine. And if you withstood them or stood in their way, you were history. They had a controlling use of their relationships. Abusive control in their relationships. They had relational ability. They had relational gifts. They were the royal couple. People wanted to spend time with them, but they did not use their relational gifts to build community. They did not leverage their relationships to create a space where those on the margins could be drawn in and feel like they belonged and were welcomed and secure. They did not use their relational connections to help everyone feel secure and loved. They used their relationships to control people and get what they wanted. And they had spiritual authority from God, spiritual gifts from God. Ahab was anointed to lead. Jezebel had gifts to teach, lead worship, prophesy, and lead prophetic people. But they did not use their spiritual authority and spiritual gifts to serve God. They did not use their spiritual gifts to bring God's people to God. They did not use their spiritual gifts to help people love God or follow God. They used their spiritual gifts to control people and get what they wanted. Now, does that sound like something familiar? Well, not in York City Church. And before we point too many fingers in too many directions, we all have to acknowledge there is something deep within us that wants to get what we want. There's a terrible flaw in all of us that wants to control people in order to get what we want. We find it very difficult to let other people be free. So we use our spiritual gifts, our pastoral gifts, our prophetic gifts, our teaching gifts. We don't use them to serve, we use them to control and make others do what we want. We use our relational ability, but we use it to get what we want. And if we don't get what we want, we get huffy and puffy and sulky and angry and gossipy and deceitful and manipulative. Think, why did Ahab and Jezebel go to such a bad place? Why? They were God's king and queen. And they got to such a bad place. And the answer was idolatry. They replaced God with their own God. You see, you can't be a person who wants to get their own way when God is God to you. When God is being God to you, you know that life is not about getting my own way. You're reminded of it every day by God being God to you. But they replaced God. They got God out of the way. And God is completely against controlling behavior. He is completely against you getting your own way, especially in his church. Jesus did not die on a cross and shed his blood to gather his church as his holy people so you can control them and get what you want from them. The mission of Elisha was to destroy idolatry and destroy controlling behavior. Jesus' mission is to destroy idolatry and eradicate controlling behavior from his people. He is my friend, Elisha. Think, well, why do these signs then? Why do this wedding wine thing and this this royal official thing and this breaking of bread thing and this raising of Lazarus thing. Well, the answer is simple. The answer is simple. There are seven features of those stories, each of which addresses the problem of control and the lack of trust in God. So number one, there's the impossibility of the situation. There's nothing like an impossible situation for helping me know I am not in charge and I cannot fix it. And that only God can deal with this. There's nothing like a good, impossible situation for reminding you that life is not about getting what you want and controlling people in order to deliver on that. Bring on the impossible situations. Number two, the need not being mine. Controlling people always think about themselves, what they want, what they need. Very difficult to remain a controlling person whilst looking at the needs of other people. Number three, the reluctant response. Delay is a control killer. The longer God takes to answer my prayers, the more I understand I'm not in charge. It kills controlling behavior, delay, and reluctance. Number four, the requirement for obedience. Do whatever he tells you. Those are the Elisha signs. Just do whatever he tells you. Just come and do that stone thing. Just come on. Come and do the whole, like, stone pushing thing. Like, no. No. I'm sorry, I'm picking on you. I have to stop being controlling when I step into that space of doing whatever Jesus tells me to do. This is why so many people refuse to become Christians. This is why so many Christians don't flourish as Christians. Because the deal is this: do whatever he tells you. I think, well, I'm not having any of that. I'm going to do what I tell myself. Control dies in this space. Control can't breathe in this space. The oxygen of control is independence and self-will. Here's another one. Being asked to participate in the miracle. Take away the stone, he said. Controlling people hate doing foolish things they know aren't going to work. Controlling people hate doing things that depend on God working to work. Here's another one. Feeling the pain. Jesus wept, it says. And the extent to which this text makes sense to you in this story is probably the extent to which you are free from control in your life. Controlling people are not interested in feeling the pain of other people. They may want to fix the problem in order to advance their own agenda, but that's very different to simply sitting in the pain of other people, which is what Jesus does. Jesus knew he couldn't solve the problem by himself. He knew he was completely dependent on the Father. He just stood there and felt the pain. And then lastly, the overwhelming abundance. 6 stone water jars. Not a matching set, gathered from the neighbours, between like 80 and 120 litres. We've averaged that at 100. 600 litres of wine, 1,000 bottles. Man, this party was the best party that ever happened in that village. Ever. And once you've been to that party, you think, I'm never going to bother being a party organizer ever again. I'm just going to, like, let Jesus do the whole wine thing. Like, the abundance crushes the need to control. Crushes it to pieces. God just goes wild. Think, well, that's my friend. That's my friend. John says this about his gospel. He says this. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written, that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name, a life free from controlling behavior, a life free from wanting to get what you want. And church, that is a great life to lead. And not for nothing does Jesus say at the very first of these signs, look, I'm not going to, like, why are you bothering me? Because my hour has not yet come. You think, well, what does problem at wedding got anything to do with crucifixion of God? How are those linked? And the answer is this. Jesus wants us to know that in his mission as Elisha, to be truly and fully and completely fulfilled, you have to come to the cross. You know, he did multiply bread so that 1,000 people could be fed, but there's a multiplication of bread going on at the cross. There's a feeding going on at the cross that way surpasses that Elisha sign. And if you want to be free from being controlling, and you want to be free from being controlled, there's one place and one place alone to come. And that is the cross. And to eat the flesh and to drink the blood of Jesus. Because it takes away all the sin. It takes it away. Eat the flesh, drink the blood, and controlling behavior is gone forever. So, sorry I've messed up this bread. Let's eat and let's drink. Jesus, we thank you so much that you have been our Elisha and brought us to this place of freedom and victory and deliverance. And we pray that as we feast on you, Lord, you might fill us and take away all our sin, take away the sin that's been done, and make us like you. Amen.